Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL Concord, New Hampshire's news radio. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, we'll be taking time to speak with Brad Cook, a New Hampshire attorney and Politico, Bob Bixby, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition, and former Ambassador and Congressman Dick Sweat. Before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. With top-line spending numbers set for fiscal years 2018 and 2019, the House and Senate are unlikely to make any headway on passing actual budget resolutions, at least for fiscal year 2019. Why? Because it would be apparently too difficult to find agreement, and it's a midterm election year, which is a politically difficult time for members of Congress to stick their necks out on potentially unfavorable reforms. Still, some members are pushing for Congress to do its job. Here's what's being said. House Budget Chairman Steve Womack plans to push forward on a fiscal 2019 budget resolution and then try to advance it out of his committee. He said, in quote, "Writing a budget is a fundamental responsibility of Congress, and as chairman of the House Budget Committee, I am wholly committed to fulfilling that duty." House Freedom Caucus Chairman Mark Meadows disagreed, saying, in quote, "There's no reason to do a budget at this point if the Senate is not going to do one." However, Senate Budget Chairman Mike Enzi is drafting a budget resolution he expects his committee to mark up, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is unlikely to bring it to the floor. I, for one, would like to see Congress get back to regular order on the budget process. It's been years since any real planning or prioritizing has been done. President Trump's $1.5 trillion infrastructure plan has not been well received on Capitol Hill. The two Republican chairmen whose committees would oversee infrastructure legislation are pushing back against the proposal, which calls for only $200 billion of the $1.5 trillion to come from the federal government. Bipartisan criticism suggests the plan may need a rewrite. House Transportation and Infrastructure Chairman Bill Shuster, a Republican from Pennsylvania, said the incentives program wouldn't work in Pennsylvania and elsewhere because it requires states to come up with new revenue they don't have, and Democrats have expressed similar doubts. The president surprised many Republicans by proposing an increase in the federal gas tax to help finance the plan, which is estimated to raise about $396 billion over 10 years, but most Republicans are leery of backing a tax increase after the major tax code overhaul. Speaking of the tax code, touting the recent changes, Republicans are now less interested in picking on the IRS. Some senators have even said it's time to stop squeezing the funding needed for the agency, with the Trump administration requesting an extra $581 million for the IRS so it could better implement the tax code overhaul. I'm pleased to welcome attorney Brad Cook to the show. Brad is a shareholder at Sheehan Finney, a law firm in Manchester, New Hampshire, where Brad also had the opportunity to work with Concord Coalition co-founder and the late Senator Warren Rudman. Brad also worked on Rudman's U.S. Senate campaign, is a known and respected Republican politico in New Hampshire, a longtime advocate for fiscal responsibility, and member of the Concord Coalition State Advisory Board. Honored to have you joining us on the program today, Brad.
Pleasure to be here.
So I've been a little nostalgic this week, and I looked up your article from 2012 for the New Hampshire Business Review, where you very kindly honored Senator Rudman after his passing. And there was a quote in it that I wanted to read. It really jumped out at me. And you say, "Almost everyone who worked for him in any capacity recounts two things. First, Rudman got them to produce more than they knew they could produce. And second, his knack for law and policy and his ability to explain it and persuade others was extraordinary." And I can't get that quote out of my head because not only do I wish he was still with us, but I wish he was still in the Senate. We could really use his persuasiveness, conviction, and leadership. And I was curious, if he were in today's Senate, what do you think he'd say to his fellow members?
Well, I think if he were in the Senate today, he'd be a very frustrated guy unless he was in the Senate with some of the people who were in at the time. I mean, times have changed tremendously. When Warren Rudman ran for the Senate, it his whole budget for the primary and general election was $400,000. I think they spent $17 million last year in the Ayotte Hassan race. And partisanship and division is so much more rampant that I think he would probably excoriate them all for not trying to find common ground and be responsible.
Are there any leaders in the Senate now from either party that are Rudman-esque and perhaps could even work together?
Oh, I think there's some. I think individually there's some fine senators. I think they're kind of trapped into a divided process that's very frustrating. I think Lindsey Graham's a good senator. I think Orrin Hatch is a very distinguished senator who was there at the time that Warren was there. I think there are a lot of fine people who, given their own druthers, would work together. I think there's a core in the Senate who helped move things along the last time they were going to do this shutdown thing. I think both of our senators from New Hampshire are part of it. I think Senator Collins from Maine is part of it. So I think there are people who want it to work, but I think the lightning rod people, the minority leader and the majority leader, and the pressures on Democrats to be partisan Democrats and Republicans to be partisan Republicans keep a lot of things from happening.
And Brett, I think you were talking about the Common Sense Coalition in the Senate and naming a few of those members. I'm curious, do you think that group will have any success in bringing some sort of bipartisan effort to, say, make headway on some of our fiscal challenges as a nation?
Well, I would hope so. This recent tax bill that passed certainly didn't have an effect on it that I wish they'd had, and I think it was especially hypocritical, at least from the Republican point of view, to say that they were deficit hawks and budget balancing hawks and then vote for something that was going to have a $1 trillion effect on the budgets.
Yeah, that's a hard pill for me to swallow as well, working for the Concord Coalition. In fact, Senator Rudman helped found the coalition, and I'm curious, how do you think he would suggest we start to get the nation's fiscal house in order?
Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter. And so I think he'd be very vocal on his outrage at what's going on. I think he would. He had a very forceful manner and a very persuasive manner that was kind of reflected in that quote you read that I wrote in 2012. Not to quote myself, but
you can quote yourself all you want, Brad.
But he, you know, he was very dynamic. He was blunt. He said what he thought, and I don't think he'd have any trouble saying it. I think he would have been right in President Trump's face saying this is wrong and we shouldn't do it.
Well, speaking of blunt and quoting yourself, you were quoted in Politico recently, and I've got your quote right here. You said, "I would say there's probably never been a more discouraging time for those concerned about the debt and the deficit because even our allies have taken a powder. I used to be optimistic that we might be able to have some influence. Now we are kind of that voice crying in the wilderness." Were you talking about organizations like the Concord Coalition, or members as a whole? You know, what was in your mind?
Well, I was talking about the Concord Coalition specifically in that one because the Politico reporter called me up as a member of the advisory board and said, "Okay, what are you guys thinking about what's going on as Concord Coalition supporters and spokesmen?" And that's what elicited the quote.
Well, you're on our advisory board for the state. What advice would you give us to help turn the corner there and actually make an impact?
Well, I think we may be the voice crying in the wilderness, but remember the original voice crying in the wilderness was John the Baptist, and he was followed immediately by Christ, so things could get better.
Was John the Baptist beheaded?
Yeah, he was, and Christ was crucified, so, you know, luckily he rose again. But the, you keep saying what ought to be, and life goes in cycles, and you keep telling the truth and elect one person at a time or persuade one person at a time, and it can get better. I mean, that core group in the Senate needs about 10 more senators to have a majority, and there's an election every 2 years.
Do you think this midterm election or even the 2020 election might be an opportunity for groups like the Concord Coalition or other similarly situated groups to have an impact in you know, getting the general public to focus on these issues?
Well, I would hope so. What's fascinating to me in watching Washington is that when Republicans are in, Democrats seem to be the people dedicated to balancing the budget and criticizing the other people. When Democrats are in, the Republicans have a tendency to do it. But when people are actually in power, the deficit doesn't seem to matter, and somebody's going to have to get the message to them that it does matter. And my fear is that the message isn't going to go through until the effect of all this deficit spending and the interest costs hamstring the country. And it's not going to be my generation that's hurt. It's going to be yours.
Yeah, and I'm hoping for the sake of my generation, you know, whoever is in the majority will step up soon and realize some tough decisions have to be made to really right the ship. This is Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. I've been talking about Warren Rudman's legacy and the need for stronger leadership on federal fiscal policy in Washington with Brad Cook. Brad, thank you so much for joining the show today.
My pleasure.
We'll be back after these short messages with former Ambassador and Congressman Dick Sweat. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the program by former Ambassador and Congressman Dick Sweat. Dick is an architect and travels all over the world with his work, something I'm actually very jealous of. He served as Ambassador to Denmark from 1998 to 2001, and as a Democratic Congressman for New Hampshire from 1991 to 1995. He's also a member of the Concord Coalition's State Advisory Board. Ambassador, it's a privilege, to have you on Facing the Future. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I always like to kick off a segment like this by asking our guests a little bit about themselves and their background. You were in Congress in an era where citizens seemingly expressed concern over federal budget deficits. And not long after your time in Congress, we saw the last budget surplus that our country has ever seen. How has the conversation and mentality of Congress, even voters, shifted since then?
Well, first, I'd like to start out by saying that I sort of came at Congress from a very different perspective. I was the only architect elected in the 20th century to be a member of Congress. You know, some compare that with Jefferson, but Jefferson was never a member of Congress. And he did serve as an ambassador at one point. Although he did architecture, he was never a legal architect because there was no such thing as a legal architecture profession back then. So these are things that, you know, sort of tie me to some important people. But I came at it from the perspective of developing renewable energy projects back in the 1980s. This is long before ice cap freezing discussions were being held or climate change discussions were being held. And I began to see that there was tremendous waste and inefficiency in our whole energy utility system. And that is what politicized me, plus the fact that the renewable resources that we had here in New Hampshire could also positively impact our environment, reducing NOx and SOx and all kinds of pollutants in the air and utilizing local resources to electrify our power grid.
So you had a creative, sort of efficiency-minded perspective coming into Congress.
And I wanted to work on energy and the built environment issues because these were the things that I knew about as an architect, as an energy developer. So I got into Congress to work on those things and very quickly realized that the political arena was starting to polarize. And this was right at the very beginning of the polarization that you talked about in your opening remarks. I think things have only gotten worse, and I don't know how we stop this, but I'm doing everything I can to be a positive force because I have always believed that you can disagree without being disagreeable.
And you talked about that polarization, and it was sort of just starting when you were there. How far have we fallen since then?
Well, right now, people don't talk to each other. When I was there, we played basketball in the members' gym. people would play tennis against each other. They would have dinners in the evenings together, you know, Republicans and Democrats. Nobody talks to each other any longer. And that's not only between the two political parties, that's also within the political parties. The conservative Democrats have nothing to do with the liberal Democrats. The conservative Republicans have nothing to do with the liberal Republicans. And we live in a time where the whole country has been fractionalized into interest groups or identity groups that the none want to talk to the other because they all can sort of put themselves in an echo chamber and only hear what they want to hear.
And so from your perspective, efficiency-minded, you know, looking for ways to get more people involved, how do we move past that divide, that partisanship, the rhetoric that sort of feeds into each side?
Well, I think we have to find people who want to solve problems as opposed to put forth political ideologies.
By people, do you mean leaders in Congress or citizens as a whole?
Well, if they don't exist in Congress, then there are no leaders in Congress.
That's
but
a good
if they
point.
Exist in the public, we've got to motivate those folks to get out and run and participate, yes.
This is Facing the Future, and I'm talking with former Ambassador and Congressman Dick Sweat. Ambassador, you're a member of the Concord Coalition State Advisory Board, and you recently brought something to my attention, the organization's attention, that I hadn't thought about in a long time, probably since high school, and that was President George Washington's farewell address from 1796. In it, he actually made some references to the nation's public credit, its debt levels. Can you share with me what took you down that road? You know, what did Washington have to say?
Well, first of all, as a member of the advisory board for the Concord Coalition, first of all, I got to tell you, I have joined every reform movement that's out there.
We're
I'm
one
part of
many.
Issue One. I'm part of, you know, the Concord Coalition. I'm, you know, part of, you know, Fix the Debt. You know, you name it. I'm on that reform movement because I think we have to reform how this country looks at these issues.
Yeah, it's certainly a multifaceted issue. It's not a one organization can fix everything sort of
but
thing.
But in that, what I have found among all of these groups is that they have very lofty goals. They want to make changes. They want to fix the problems. But they have no story to tell. And my feeling is that if we as a nation are going to unify once again, we have to find a story, a common story that we can all share and we can all get behind. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't have to do with our ethnicity. It doesn't have to do with our gender. It has to do with our Americanness, and it has to do with what we as a country want to lay out as the purpose for our being and how we're going to go forward. And as I've looked through the ages, or looked through the pages, I should say, of materials about, you know, what makes America unique, I came across Washington's farewell address again. You know, going back to high school days, maybe it was the last time I even ever, you know, cracked it. And I saw in that a document that had six pillars that were from our founding fathers' mouth that addressed all of the problems that we're experiencing today, whether it has to do with national unity, whether it has to do with fiscal discipline, whether it has to do with education for the overall population. You know, these are all pillars that he felt if they were not retained and kept strong, the nation would crumble. And by gosh, that's what I'm seeing. And why not bring back George Washington to sort of talk about these things? Now, his tweet was 6,000 words, so we got to break it down.
Which we did.
Yeah. So I saw it, and I thought that was well done. And I've actually done the same thing, you know, to try and cover the six pillars as well.
But, so for those who may not know, the Concord Coalition took George Washington's persona or voice, as it were, and had him tweet for the coalition back in December. But before we jump into those tweets, I do want to get your perspective on a couple of those pillars. You mentioned national unity and fiscal discipline or responsibility. Mm-hmm. Can you expound on what he had to say about
this? Well, he said, and this is the order of importance that he laid out. He said that, you know, national unity was number one paramount of importance because if we cannot, as a country, retain a unified approach, we will not be able to defend ourselves. We will not be able to establish the kinds of quality of life that all of our students should deserve and be able to aspire aspire to. So national unity is so important. The second thing is this whole fractionalism that we've seen the country devolve into with the representation of identity groups. They used to call it special interests. Now they're called identity groups. But all of these different groups that are vying for the sort of the upper hand in the public square, we ought to be all working together. It's not a problem that we have differences of opinion, but we ought to be able to do this in a way that those differences make each of these groups stronger and fit to the greater whole to a much greater extent.
Right. We sort of demonize and make enemies now, as opposed to acknowledging that we have differences and finding ways to bridge the gaps.
And that's what was starting back in the 1990s. I saw that happening. I mean, when I had my Senate race, I ran against a candidate who did that very thing. He personalized everything. He demonized the opponent. And that, I think, we have to get away from. The third thing is fiscal discipline. You know, having debt, the use of our credit. Washington understood that was absolutely necessary,
right.
But he saw it in terms of emergency, not in terms of everyday life. You know,
yeah.
This isn't like, well, I'm going to go buy a car, so I'm going to pay credit for it no matter what.
Right.
I mean, all of my cars I've bought for cash because that's one thing I can make sure I don't, load myself up with debt on.
Yeah.
And that's the way that we as a country need to treat our national debt and our credit.
And if I want to pluck one line out of what Washington said was, in quote, as a very important source of strength and security, cherish public credit. And he later goes on to say cherishing it means using it sparingly.
Yeah, yeah. And cherish is, I mean, isn't that a beautiful term? I mean, it has value.
Right.
It's something that one looks at and feels sensitive to and protective of, as opposed to just sort of like blowing through the spending limits.
Which is what we're doing right now.
Of course, every 3 weeks we have a new, we raise the debt ceiling and off we go. So that's the third. The fourth is that he talks about virtues and religious freedom. And that is so important because we need a common ideal set of virtues that this country, ethics and virtues that we operate by. And we don't talk about that anymore. We don't have that discussion in our families at home. We don't have that discussion in our schools. And we need to have that because that is what gives us a common sense of how we treat one another and how we act professionally and in our business endeavors, in our political endeavors, and all of the things that we endeavor to transact in our national community. But we also need to have religious freedom. Washington understood that religion, yes, it could be divisive, but if everybody has equal and unfettered access to the religions of their choice, the ethics and values of those religions at their fundamental level would contribute to and help be a strong foundation under this country and keep us all in line. And I think he very much valued that, and that was his fourth pillar. Fifth is education. Without an informed public, we have no informed public opinion. Look at where we are now. Everybody has their idea. There's fake news about everything. No one believes anything. We are a bunch of skeptics, and all we have to do is shout louder than the other person to believe that we think we have the truth.
And now we have the ability to simply feed into one source of news or information to support our own existing ideology, as opposed to challenging ourselves to look beyond our own sphere of influence, our own realm of understanding.
Yeah, I hate it. I have to watch like three different TV shows every night to get the news because I don't want to see just what Fox or what CNN or MSNBC have to say. I got to see what the others are saying about the same thing.
And I'm the typical millennial because I hardly watch television news. I'm online siphoning from six or seven different sources.
And online I go to Real Clear Politics.
Yeah.
And Real Clear Politics, they pull everything so I can grab again from all the different ideological perspectives. But it triples, quadruples the time it takes me to sort of ingest what's going on in the world and understanding it better. And that's a real, that's a real turnoff for a lot of people.
Yeah.
They don't have the time and maybe, or the inclination for that matter.
And what was the sixth
one? Then the sixth one is our involvement internationally. We should have peaceful, strong relationships with our international neighbors, and we should be avoiding conflicts. We should be avoiding picking winners or particular allies over everyone else. We should be actually mediating and working towards peace throughout the world. And that's something that Washington was very concerned about, that he didn't want to see the country sort of become entangled in foreign affairs to the extent that it did two things. One, it cost treasure, and it cost blood. And those are two valuable assets that he felt, you know, we should take very seriously and not expend unless we absolutely had to. And so I think those were the six pillars that he said, if these things don't stay strong, this country will not stay strong. And I'm very concerned about that.
And unfortunately, we're running low on time. So what I want to do now is I'd like to ask you, I know you love a good narrative. And I'm curious if you could do your best George Washington impression here and perhaps share a message as if you were the first president of our country, one of our forefathers, tying all six of those pillars together. You know, what message would you communicate today?
Well, I think the most important thing that we as a nation have to recognize is that without strong unity, we will devolve into regional factions, into economic factions, into ethnic factions, into a whole group of adversarial engaged communities that cannot withstand the test of time. And that's why it's so important that we not only stand as a unified nation, but that we moderate our politics in such a way that we can all get along. And in doing so, we must be able to balance our budgets. We must be able to maintain fiscal discipline. We must be able to educate our population in a way that everybody has the knowledge and the ability to engage in meaningful and knowledgeable discourse about what direction this country should go. And most importantly, we should do it with an ethical and a virtuous set of principles that keeps us mindful of the good people we are, of the good things that we have done and continue to do and need to do in the world. And that gives us definition. It doesn't define us by color. It doesn't define us by gender. It defines us by action. And if we can take action that provides the world the needed leadership, the needed ethical and principled foundation, so that all countries, all peoples can get along and can figure out how to coexist together, just as we as a country have done. I mean, we're a melting pot. We have certainly our fights out in the streets, but we are a melting pot that has demonstrated that as the strongest and longest lived democracy, we are making that example available to the world. And if we can do that and engage peacefully and constructively with our international neighbors, then we have the opportunity of returning ourselves to my original ideals. This is Washington speaking, if we remember. My original ideals of what a great nation ought to be.
Well, I don't know that I could have said it any better myself, Ambassador. This is Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. I've been talking federal fiscal policy and President George Washington's advice to our nation with former Ambassador and Congressman Dick Sweat. Ambassador, thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
We will be back after these short messages with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. You are listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and Bob Bixby, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition, is calling in from Washington. Thanks for joining Facing the Future, Bob.
Thanks for having me again, Chase.
Always a pleasure to talk to the Executive Director. So today I want to talk a little bit about an issue that's near and dear to the Concord Coalition. It goes to our very core principles, and that is the concept of sustainable fiscal policy. And I wanted to rewind a couple decades back to 1994 when President Clinton created the Bipartisan Commission on Entitlement and Tax Reform. Then the commission's members agreed that fiscal trends were unsustainable. Can you paint us a quick picture of what the budget outlook was like then? What was, in fact, unsustainable?
Well, there's a basic structural mismatch between spending and revenues. And what basically drives the spending higher on autopilot is our major entitlement programs, primarily Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, things that are related to retirement and health care. Those are pre-programmed, you might say, to rise faster than the economy because of the aging population. There'll be more beneficiaries and more people will be consuming health care, which tends to rise faster than general inflation. So even, and it tends to rise faster than revenues. So even assuming that revenues would keep up with economic growth, people looked at the situation back in the 94 Commission and said, boy, when the boomers begin to retire, we're going to not, the budget will simply be unsustainable because the gap between projected spending levels and projected revenue levels is going to produce such large deficits that ultimately nobody would lend us the money. Now, they weren't saying that Armageddon was going to hit in a couple of years. They were warning about a something that would come to pass.
And in some ways, is it fair to say that the
commission was quite prescient in that certainly the retirement of the boomers is having an effect on the budget now.
So I was going to say, is it fair to say that, you know, those warnings are sort of coming home to roost in present day? You know, we have expanding, growing federal budget deficits. Our national debt is at its highest point as a percentage of the economy since the World War II era. You know, is everything that was of concern in the 90s happening now?
Yes. Now, a lot happened in between, and it shouldn't be forgotten that we had a period in the 90s right after the Kerry Danforth Commission where things improved considerably because people did take the warnings seriously, and both the Clinton administration and the Republican Congress get a lot of credit, I think, for the way that they responded to warnings and did engage in some fiscally responsible actions. Plus, we had some good luck, which was the end of the Cold War did produce a peace dividend. And we had a good economy in the 1990s. So the things that the Kerry Danforth Commission warned about didn't happen as soon as was warned about in the report. And that also meant that interest costs on the debt were not anywhere near as great because the debt wasn't as great in the short term. Now, then you fast forward, things turned bad again. Frankly, the Bush administration engaged in a combination of tax cuts, entitlement expansions with Medicare prescription drugs, and going to war. There's quite a combination there that, whatever you think of the individual policies, was bad for the budget. And so we got back into a deficit situation.
And then
came the Great
Recession.
Yeah, well, the Great Recession really threw things out of whack, and so by the time that was over with, we were into the boomer retirement years, and that's kind of where we are now.
And so we went through sort of a things getting better around the turn of the century, went downhill again, and now, at least from my perspective, after the Great Recession, things were migrating in the right direction, you know. Deficits were going down, the economy was starting to grow, and it also seems that now we're hitting another rough patch. New policies coming into Congress are going the opposite direction in terms of sustainability. We had a big tax cut. We've got some new spending bills that bust through previously set caps. What's it look like moving forward from here in terms of fiscal policy?
Well, it looks a lot like, strangely, the outlook that faced the Kerry Danforth Commission, just separated by about 20 years. It's kind of like Rip Van Winkle. You went to sleep under a tree and woke up 20 years later. And the different, because the projections are for rising and unsustainable debt, and the difference is that our debt is a lot higher than it was 20 years ago. We basically spent that time doing some good things, some bad things, but it did not change the overall track of fiscal policy. So
do you think we're
looking at trillion-dollar deficits, by next year? And the problem there is that it's not because of a bad economy or a major war or something like that. It's because we've simply committed too much to spending and cut revenues in such a way that, we're $1 trillion short.
And, Bob, it seems pretty reasonable that we would have larger deficits in a time of recession and even shortly thereafter. Do you think we've missed a window of time when the economy was or is growing at a pretty steady level where we could have made some changes in fiscal policy to help make them a little more sustainable? We've certainly thrown the baby out with the bathwater now. We've given up on fiscal responsibility, it almost seems. But was there a window there where we could have made some changes pretty quickly to put us on a better path?
It's awfully difficult in the middle of the big recession that we were having. But I do think that a window was missed towards the end of the recession when we were coming out of it. There was a time, the Simpson-Bowles Commission, which was appointed by President Obama, reported at the end of 2010, and the Bipartisan Policy Center Rivlin-Domenici Task Force, which I was on, reported at the same time, came out to very similar conclusions, and that was the window of opportunity to do something because there was interest in the Obama administration, there was interest in the Congress, and you might remember then Speaker John Boehner and President Obama came very close to putting a deal together, but at the last minute it fell apart, and from that point on, it seemed like neither party was quite willing to make the hard choices that would be necessary to make that deal work. And so when that deal fell apart, we haven't had anything approaching that since in terms of an attempt to deal with the long-term fiscal outlook.
And I would attribute a failure in political leadership from both parties and for that sort of grand bargain falling through. So we're looking ahead at the next couple decades. In the short term, if a grand bargain is out the window, in the short term, what should Congress be focusing on in terms of reform? What needs to be addressed before something negative really happens?
I guess we're kind of back to taking baby steps, and I'd just like to see them stick to the revised and upward budget caps that they just passed. Let's try to do appropriations right and without raising the caps or engaging in gimmicks. And I'd look at the revenue side again and see if there are some ways that they could bring in new revenue because, frankly, we're going to need it. Not necessarily by raising rates, but maybe by looking at some of those tax expenditures that complicate the tax code and see if we can close some loopholes and bring in some revenues. And I think we should concentrate on healthcare costs. I mean, I really think that's the big driver. And if Congress, if Democrats and Republicans can get together on ways to slow healthcare spending, and I'm not talking about federal spending, I'm not talking about, cutting Medicare or cutting Medicaid or anything. If we are able to control the underlying cost of providing health care, the cost of those programs will go down. So I would look for some reforms to those programs that come from reforming health care in general. And if you look at the Obama, at the Trump budget, they made some proposals in that regard that were very similar to things that Obama had proposed. It might not produce dramatic savings right away, but That's really the key is healthcare cost.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with Bob Bixby, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition. Bob, unfortunately, we're running short on time, and I wanted to shift gears a little bit. I got a little reminiscent or nostalgic this week. I happen to have a Concord Coalition coffee mug. On that mug is, an outdated logo, a phone number that doesn't work anymore, and a debt chart that puts the debt on a path to reach $7 trillion. And of course, it's essentially tripled since then. But I decided to Google the phone number for the Concord Coalition from the 90s, and it brought me to an article in the Orlando Sentinel from 1993. And it had some really interesting things to say about Concord's own mission, and then some budget proposals or resolutions that had been introduced at that time. One of them was a five-year budget plan that almost passed the House with margins that I think you wouldn't see today in terms of how close they were, and President Clinton actually supported it and got freshman Democrats to support it because they were campaigning on the populist idea at the time of slashing federal deficits. Do you think anything like that would even be introduced on the floor these days?
Well, that's truly nostalgic for me. I think you were, what, 5 years old at the time?
I thought we weren't going to talk about that, Bob.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, no, I remember it well, and I would like to get that feeling back again. I think if we get the American people involved in, you know, demanding action, you might get people running on reducing the deficit as we had in those days on both sides. And what was remarkable about the Kasich Penny plan, or Penny Kasich plan,
which was the name of the plan I mentioned. I didn't say that.
Yeah, it was John Kasich and Tim Penny, a former congressman from Minnesota who's now on our board, and who will be joining me at the National Press Club for a chat on Friday. But anyway, a couple of things remarkable about it. One, it was bipartisan. Two, it did take some tough measures to reduce the deficit. And three, the House leadership let it come up for a vote. You're operating in this such a partisan territory now where the House leadership won't let a bill come up unless it has so-called the majority of the majority support. And that limits what can come up with bipartisan sponsorship. So I'd like to get back to that era where you could have bipartisan cooperation on budget resolutions. It didn't pass, but it did put a lot of pressure on the leadership, on the administration to change their budget and respond to the bipartisan push for a fiscal deficit reduction plan.
And it seemed that pressure was coming even from within Congress versus some outside political force, which nowadays, as you mentioned, is really all that Congress is concerned about, you know, how it's going to impact them in the next election. So I would like to see some renewed leadership in Congress on some of these issues. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I've been discussing whether fiscal policy is currently sustainable with Bob Bixby, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition. We'll be back after these short messages and our final segment, Facing the Facts. Bob, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So it's time to face this fact. Not all budget deficits are created equal. It is important to distinguish between cyclical and structural deficits. Cyclical deficits are caused by a weak economy. Recessions drive down government revenue because many workers and businesses are no longer earning as much taxable income. At the same time, government spending rises because more people need assistance through programs such as Medicaid and unemployment benefits. Such spending, often referred to as automatic stabilizers, help to maintain demand in an economy that does not have enough of it to keep going. They produce a temporary or cyclical increase in the deficit. Once the economy recovers, tax revenue and government spending on assistance programs should return to normal levels. If government spending exceeds tax revenue even when the economy is strong, however, then the deficit is structural. Unlike cyclical deficits, structural deficits reflect a chronic problem that must be addressed through significant changes in tax and spending policies. With structural deficits, one-time spending cuts or temporary tax increases may help to relieve the pressure but cannot solve the long-term problem. A temporary spike in deficits to combat a short-term national emergency is reasonable, but a national debt that consistently grows faster than even a healthy economy is not sustainable, which is what we're experiencing right now. A textbook example of cyclical deficits is the Great Recession and the policies used to help reduce the economic fallout. And the deficits that now remain, even after a steady economic recovery, are a textbook example of structural deficits. Even assuming a strong economy with no cyclical deficit, current policies will mean structural deficits and a steadily rising debt-to-GDP ratio for as far as the eye can see, which will eventually lead to a debt burden too great to handle if reforms are not made. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.